Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today is Ben Harris. He's a board-certified master arborist and owner of Branch to Bud Tree Care, and we're going to talk about shrubs and trees, pruning, diseases, insects, and if you have any questions or comments, this is a taped program, but you can still send your questions or comments, zestygarden@gmail.com. or post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Ben, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
All right, so we've talked about pruning on this show for, you know, any number of years, and we have Mike Coons come in, and you know, I think I want to start talking about shrubs because we really haven't talked shrubs before, and most shrubs are woody. People think of them woody plants. They're going to stick around from one year to the next. Mm-hmm. And so my first question, and just throwing you a curveball, how can we get people to quit, in my opinion, get people to quit planting fire?
Burning bush. All we need is a good substitute with red fall color.
Okay. Is there a good substitute with good red fall color?
Not quite like burning bush. And it's a shame. You know, burning bush is a fickle plant. It likes a very narrow range of conditions. You get it too cold, too hot, it dies. You get it too wet, too dry, it dies. And it is just a shrub, so it's not the end of the world, but you'll often see people plant them in long rows, you know, kind of monoplants, and then one or two die out of that. And that's, you know, then you got this gap tooth kind of appearance. So if you can plant them just singly, one here, one there, that's great. But I would definitely avoid planting them as a group or on moss. And that is kind of a curveball. People do this, ask me all the time, what should I plant? And I think, let me get back to you in 2 hours and it'll come to me. The thing about burning bush is it has a nice compact form. There are other plants with good red fall color like viburnum. American cranberry bush is a great one. Some species of viburnum do, some don't. But American cranberry bush is great. It doesn't quite have the compactness of burning bush, though. It's kind of a taller plant. Some are. There are some nine bark that have some nice red fall color. And again, that's
nine bark.
Yeah. Okay. Again, that's a bit of a taller shrub. So burning bush kind of has its own little niche there, being a very compact and very reliable fall color plant. But I would avoid planting it in a large grouping.
Well, I'm kind of an anti whatever popular kind of guy.
Yeah, right.
I would rip out the maple tree in my Norway maple in the backyard if it wasn't so big and providing shade.
Yeah.
But I had three burning bushes on the south side of the house. They never got red. I think I had them for 5 years and they never went red.
That's interesting.
They went dry, which I think because they were right where they were up against the south side of the house, they just didn't get as much moisture as they needed. Mm-hmm. And that probably affected the color as well, but
sure
I just thought, I'm pulling these things out. Too many people have them anyway, so.
Yeah, yeah. There is definitely a case to be made for unique and interesting plants, and commonality breeds contempt. The more often we see a plant, I think the less regard we have for it.
Well, there's such a range of shrubs and bushes to have. Some of the ones I like for winter color would be the dogwoods, mm-hmm. like the yellow twig or red twig.
Yeah, those are great. Those are great shrubs, and that's one that I don't get tired of seeing. It's very common, but that is very interesting. So another shrub that I think we mentioned, nine bark. That's kind of a nice one because it has a kind of an exfoliating bark. It's kind of a striated appearance that shows up in the wintertime, and that's really nice. And of course, I'm a little more versatile in trees than shrubs. There are a lot of shrubs that don't even really make it on my radar for whatever reason. But I could, you know, there are a number of small trees that have great winter interest as well.
Okay.
Because of their berries. One is Lavelle hawthorn is a nice shrub, a nice small tree. Going into winter, it has a waxy green leaf. And the berries come on, they're thick and red, and they really turn color right at late fall. So usually just about when snow's getting ready to come. And it's almost like a holly effect. It's very Christmas-like. And the contrast to that is just spectacular. Another one that people really enjoy for winter effect is mountain ash because it has an orange berry, and that persists.
Do you find sometimes that there are issues with iron chlorosis with the ashes?
With the mountain ash, can be, yeah. Not the regular ash, yeah. Just the mountain ash. Yeah, in fact, I was talking to someone today that said their mountain ash didn't look good, and my first thought was, well, it's probably chlorosis. And there are a number of other problems with the mountain ash. So again,
but they can sure look good.
They're very pretty shrubs, or very pretty trees, excuse me, but it's not one you want to plan on having for a long, long time. Chances are it won't live, you know, 10, 15 years probably is the average lifespan, if that.
What about anything native? Can you think of any native shrubs that would be good to put in?
You know, I think a very nice native shrub, and call it a shrub or a small tree, it kind of is right there on the threshold, is the mountain mahogany. It's a very slow-growing plant, so if you ever get it to be a tree, you know, that'll be a good long while. And the curly-leaf mountain mahogany has a thin little kind of a curlicue a growth that hangs down. It's a very unique plant, and I think the plant itself is very attractive.
It's almost like a fuzzy cat whisker.
Yeah, a long, curly cat whisker. And you know, offhand, I'm not even sure what part of the plant it is, if it's the seed pod or the seed itself, but it's very, very eye-catching, unique. That's a great native shrub. The dogwood is a great native shrub, and you know, usually you see that as a red-stem dogwood, but it's very closely related to the dogwoods that we have growing here. In the riparian areas.
How do you keep the color on the dogwoods? Is it mostly through the renewal pruning?
You mean in the stems?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, the younger stems definitely usually have the better color, and periodically cutting out the older stems, or even periodically pruning the plant down, letting it regrow from the root zone, is a good way to keep the color on those. And also to control the size and the height. Sometimes they get a little rangy or too tall. And that's a good way to control them.
I know a family that lives a couple of blocks up from me who these dogwoods have been there for decades, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Red twig, they're probably 10 feet tall, maybe 10 feet thick getting through them. And there's no color on them in the winter, mostly because it's all old.
Yeah,
it's all old wood.
I would imagine a lot of that is dead. A lot of the interior is just dead wood, dead old wood. Cutting those down low and letting them regrow would be like getting a whole new plant on steroids.
How do you get a butterfly bush to grow in Cache County?
That's a good trick.
I've seen protected places, like an LDS church in Hyde Park used to have one up on the bench, and I think it's because it's up on the bench.
Yeah.
And it was on the west side of the building, and I'm like, this is not fair. This thing keeps coming back, and it's not just from the ground. It was above ground stems. Uh-huh. Yeah,
most of the time in burning bush that I've seen, they do grow back from the base. The upper aerial parts die off, the branches, and they die off in the wintertime, and so you get them growing back from the base. And they'll keep doing that periodically. And fortunately, they flower on the current season wood, so they'll flower and they'll look pretty good. But I haven't seen many that have actually persisted and had live branches from one season to the next. But you're right, doing it up on the bench is the best bet, because the cold settles down to the deeper parts of the valley, and up on the bench it's a little hardier. And of course, you know, that all just depends on the year. You can have a burning bush that does great for 10 years.
You mean butterfly bush?
A butterfly bush. It does great for 10 years, and then we get one cold snap, and
it's gone.
And it's done.
Well, yeah. The flowers sure smell really good, though.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
And if you hatch monarch butterflies like we do at our house, they sure love being on them as well. So.
Yeah, they're a gorgeous shrub.
What about something like a desert willow?
Ah, a desert willow. There are a few here.
Are there?
Now, okay. Not the straight-up desert willow, but the hybrids. Desert willow is a very unique plant because there's a variety of it, a hybrid available that's actually an intergeneric hybrid. It's a hybrid with a species, a plant from a different genus. They're in the same family. So desert willow.
What's
which
the cultivar, do you remember?
It's called Catalpa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it crosses with Catalpa. Desert willow, which is Chilopsis, which is the genus, crosses with Catalpa and produces the Catalpa. And it's a very popular plant, both desert willow and Catalpa, down in southern Utah. Desert willow is not quite as cold hardy as Catalpa is. So I think getting desert willow to grow, you'd have to have a very unique microclimate. But you might have more success with Catalpa. I know of one in Logan that Roger Kellgren is growing, And the last time that I saw it, it was still doing very well.
Because they have a humongous tap root that goes down looking for water.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how well it would do in a high water table area.
That's a good question, whether it would adapt and start producing some more lateral roots, or whether it would, you know, whether having that one main tap root would lead to oxygen deprivation. That's a good question. Experiment.
I know I haven't had luck with trying to grow a buffalo berry, which is another shrub that I see in southern Utah quite a bit, and it's not native to Cache Valley by any means, but again, always looking around for something a little bit different to try to put in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a look then at trees in general. So what do you normally see are some of the practices that homeowners do that probably shouldn't be done, and maybe some of the ones we should be considered to do?
That's a great question. And really the thing is where to start, because everybody likes trees, and most of what I see happen to trees is very well intentioned. So I don't make anybody feel bad that they've done wrong by their tree, even though sometimes things we do to them, you know, trees grow in spite of what we do to them and not because of it a lot of times. So this time of year, specifically, we do see a lot of fruit tree pruning, and it's a great time of year to prune fruit trees because they have a lot of diseases and insect problems that are dormant right now. So there's very low risk of infection from diseases like fire blight. And very low risk of spreading that through your pruning activities. And now that we've passed the worst part of the winter, there's low risk of making them less cold hardy by pruning them, which can happen in the fall. So what we see a lot of times is people going out and just topping their tree, just indiscriminately taking the top portion out of their tree because they want it at a certain height. I think this happens a lot because you see the orchards, and they prune their trees to be very low and very broad and very open, which is great for fruit production. It makes the fruit easier to access, to thin and to spray and to pick, and it lets a lot of sunlight into the canopy. And so people see that, and they want to keep their fruit trees low so they can pick them easier, and also, you know, just it's kind of a conventional wisdom. But the orchards will train their trees to have that structure very early on. The very first pruning they do is to train them to have that low, broad habit. And a lot of people will have old trees, especially old apple trees or cherry trees that get pretty large, and they'll want to come in, trees that haven't been pruned for years, and they decide either they buy the property or they suddenly decide they want to start producing fruit, and they want to make them low. And so what we see is a lot of branches removed out of the tree and a lot of big cuts. And that's hard on the tree for a number of reasons. You don't want to remove more than about a quarter of the living foliage out of the tree in a single season. The leaves are what produces the tree's food. It's not minerals or water that takes up to the soil. It's the leaves. So if you take more than a quarter of the leaves out, it impacts the tree's ability to produce food for itself. And the tree will respond by trying to produce more leaves. It's just a natural reaction. So you'll see where trees have been severely pruned, you get these upright water sprouts that go straight up in the air. That's just the tree's reaction to having been pruned severely and trying to get some leaves going immediately. So one thing is you don't want to prune more than a quarter of the foliage off. And if that means that you can't take the height down as much as you want to the first year, it's much better to do that in stages, carefully, over time. Because you can prune it so hard that the tree just grows right back as tall as it was originally, and you've kind of defeated the whole purpose. And the other thing is making large cuts on the tree. Most fruit trees are not good at keeping decay from spreading, especially apples and cherries. Once you make a large wound on that tree from a pruning cut, decay gets in there and it spreads through the branch, moves downward, and once it decays in, you'll never get it out. The tree just does its best to keep it from spreading to other parts of the tree. So in general, you want to keep your pruning cuts to 2 inches or smaller, no bigger than 4 inches if you really have to. But you should have a good reason for that. You know, dead branch, definitely. Branch that's hitting the house, yeah, that's pretty important. But if you don't have to make a large cut, it's much better to make a small cut. So when people come in and just take the tops out of trees, they take all the foliage out in one season, or most of it, and then they also make these large cuts, which let decay down into the branches, and which the trees will have to struggle with now for years, and makes the branches much weaker.
I've got a green ash that someone 25, 30 years ago cut I'd say 15, 18 inch. I mean, they basically topped the tree. They must have had three large branches, and just they just cut them right off. And the one side of the tree has grown back. It's my air conditioner for the house. I don't have one in the house, and it keeps the house cool because it grows pretty much over this steeply pitched roof. But I just noticed this past week, I got looking at the other cut, and you can see the bark is separating below it on the bottom side of where that cut was made, and that whole side of the tree is dead, going down like 4 or 5 feet from where this cut was made, about 10 feet up. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably going to end up losing the whole tree because of the way that it was taken care of, the way it got topped.
Well, it definitely shortened the life of your tree. And whether it's to the point now where it needs to come out or whether it has some more time, you know, you'd have to do some careful investigation. But anytime a tree is topped, it will never recover and be what it once was. A branch that's grown naturally has a very strong attachment, usually. If it's a large trunk and a smaller branch, relatively, the branch has a core of wood that goes into the trunk, actually, and provides it a lot of hydraulic support. But when you top a tree, those sprouts that come out are very weakly attached, just to the very outer layer of bark, and they're very easy to rip out in a windstorm or a snowstorm. And when in a topping cut, you also get decay spreading through the branch, and so you get the center with decay, and then on the outside a very thin layer of wood in which are attached these thin water sprouts, very dense, and it's bad news all around. It's a recipe for disaster. There is no, you know, tree science has been looking at pruning for the last 50 years, and no one has ever found a benefit to trees from topping. Every research study that's ever been done on the subject has found that topping is detrimental to the tree in many ways. So usually what I tell clients who are interested in topping is there's a lot of ways to do what topping does, reduce the height, reduce the risk of tree failure in ways that are much healthier for the tree. If there is no other option, then removal and replacement is usually a much better option than topping, because you don't end up with a more dangerous tree down the road.
I was going to say, you might as well just take it out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to give up this tree because of what it's providing for the house, but I don't know. I just think, because I lost a large branch off of it last year, and that was probably one of those water sprouts, and it was about 6 or 7 inches in diameter, and it was growing straight up from where the cuts had been made, and that had become basically the scaffold of the tree, but you can look at it and know that they're not attached all that great. So
yeah, so a lot of times replacement is a better option than topping. It just opens up a whole nest of worms.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. I have with me Ben Harris. He's a board certified master arborist and owns the company Branch to Bud Tree Care. If you'd like to make a question or comment, the program is taped, but you can send your question or comment to zestygarden@gmail.com or post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Before we get into talking more about trees and pruning, I'm just curious, where are the best places to purchase trees? I mean, this time of year is usually you're going to find your best selection, but I also, you know, like I'll look online. I've got a company that I like in the Northwest that I usually buy my fruit trees from, because great customer care. I get healthy trees that are a half inch to three quarter in diameter, and they're really inexpensive compared to some of these catalog companies that just charge for pencil thin material.
You know, internet and catalog tree orders are becoming more and more common. And
especially if there's a certain cultivar.
If you're looking for a very unique tree, something that's not very common, then that sometimes that's the only place you'll find it. And we have a few websites that we use quite regularly. We like a lot, but we certainly don't know the breadth of what's out there. I mean, there's new companies coming up all the time.
Do you tend to avoid the big box stores?
We
go
do.
More local?
We do that. Yeah, we do try to use local nurseries where we can. For one reason, for that is the box stores from what I understand, the box stores are run by a central purchasing unit, and they'll buy trees from anywhere in the country to ship to this one store. So the local stores really don't have much control over where they get their trees from. They're just shipped in by the purchasing agent. So you can get trees from the South, you know, southeast from Southern California, places that really are not the same climate wise at all. And Providence can make a big difference in the survivability of your tree. You know, sugar maple grows from all the way from Maine down to Florida. And so you get a sugar maple that's grown in any one of that range, and whether it comes from the south or from the north can completely determine whether it'll be cold hardy here. So local nurseries I like because they have local expertise, and I've had good experiences with almost every nursery in the valley and many of the nurseries outside the valley. A lot of them will grow their plants here. I get them as small whips and grow them here on site for several years, and that they're established and cold hardy at that point. You know, you're not bringing in something fresh that year that may not even make it through the first winter. Box stores sometimes tend to be cheaper, so it just depends on whether you like enjoy gambling.
Maybe only in the short run, though.
Just in the short run. I mean, if you figure that a tree costs $100 to buy for maybe a 5-gallon or a 7-gallon plant, and then you invest your time into planting it, and it doesn't even make it past 1 year, then yeah, that's just been an expensive experiment. And so I always try to go local with the nurseries, just because your customer service is usually better, the quality of the plants is usually much better, how they're handled and taken care of is much better, and you just get better peace of mind and a much better chance of having a tree that'll do well in the long term, which, you know, you're going to have this tree for decades. And so I think it's well worth putting a little more investment in the front end to make sure that it's going to do well for decades instead of having to replace it at some point early on. It's kind of a waste of money for one thing, and also the time that you could have invested into growing a good tree and then putting on growth and getting closer to enjoying the tree that you eventually want to have.
Well, let's talk about some tree varieties. And early in the program, of course, I mentioned how I like to do things a little bit different. I like wandering around the university campus because there are usually different looking trees than I'm going to see anywhere else. And that's where I picked up my Himalayan white pine.
Oh, you have one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's about 10 feet tall right now. Uh-huh. and looks really, really good. And it's going to do better once this ash eventually comes out, I'm sure, but beautiful looking tree. Yeah. But I would never have known how something could look so pretty without seeing it somewhere else on
campus. Around.
So that's always a good thing to do, just wander around.
Campus is a fantastic resource for trees. We have some amazing trees here. We have 23 trees that are on the state large tree register, the largest trees of their species in the state. And we have over 220 different species of trees, which is phenomenal for a campus. There are those campuses in the back east, which with much better growing conditions that have a much lower diversity. So we are very fortunate to have such a good diversity. And a lot of that is due to some great arborists, campus arborists in the past, particularly Eric Hale. He used to plant trees in that I swear from outer space. I never would have never even knew they were on the map. And if Eric hadn't told me what they were, I don't think I'd ever be able to ID them. They're so rare and unique, but they're doing well here. And that kind of experimentation and outside the box thinking, I think has really made our campus a lot better place.
So what would you recommend for a homeowner? And I think it depends on, you know, what kind of space they have to put it in. But there's another there's another thing to consider. How large will this tree get when it's fully mature?
Yeah, and you talk about, we talked earlier about what kind of things I see that homeowners are doing that they maybe could do better. And that's a huge one, is find out what kind of a tree you want, what you want it to do, how big you want it to get, and then go off of that. Just don't go into the nursery and buy the first thing that looks nice. You may be very surprised within a few years. So you want to consider the size of the tree and what kind of soil you have, what kind of drainage, what kind of sun exposure. Are there overhead lines? Are there underground utilities? The building's going to be nearby. And find trees that are suited to that purpose. And selecting a tree is like picking a flavor of ice cream. I mean, there's so many choices to choose from that making a recommendation about one specific tree without knowing a little more about what a homeowner is looking for is pretty difficult. But there are some good resources. Campus is a great resource. And actually, my graduate project was mapping the trees on campus and making that available as a website. So there's a website. If you Google USU tree map, that'll bring up the website, and you can search for specific trees, and it'll show you where they are on campus. Or you can identify specific trees on a map. You know, if you know where the building where you're at, you can go to the website and say, I'm looking for this tree there, and it'll bring up the information about it, tell you what it is, what size it is, any other interesting things we know about it. And that's a great resource because you can actually come up to campus and look at trees that you're interested in and see how they're doing. Or if there's one that catches your eye, you can go find out what it is and go from there.
There's one across the parking lot that I've walked by, and I'm like, is that a bald cypress? It's right by, I think it's Richards Hall, not Richards, it's one of the halls down on the end, and it always loses its needles.
Yeah, that's a great tree. That's actually a Don Redwood.
Oh, okay.
But like bald cypress, it's a deciduous conifer. And there's a really interesting story behind that tree, which I'm not sure if we have time to get into now, but...
It was go ahead.
Okay, so it was on the brink of extinction. Actually, we thought it was extinct. And we've seen trees of the very similar to it in the botanical record, in the fossil record, excuse me. And during World War II, Chinese botanists found a very small population living in China. Shortly after the war, the U.S. Arboretum sent an expedition. They gathered seed, and they sent it to arboreta around the world and gardens. And it's thriving around the world now as a landscape plant, still critically endangered in its native habitat. And, you know, before that point, we thought this was a tree that had existed once and was long gone. Mm. So it's really, it's kind of an older tree, and it's one that's come back from the brink of extinction thanks to landscaping.
And it's a Don Redwood?
Don Redwood.
It seems like it doesn't grow very fast.
That's just that one that you're looking at.
Okay.
It had a very strange... structure, a very strange shape when it early on, and it's taken us quite a while to kind of undo that. Actually, Don Redwood is one of the best fast-growing trees, and from everything that I've seen and I've tried here in the valley, it does very well. I've never seen any winter damage. I've rarely seen chlorosis because inability to get iron from the too high of a soil pH. And there are some specimens. We don't have any really nice specimens. I see a few here in the valley, here and there, that are really looking nice. The BYU campus has a specimen that's just beautiful. I mean, just you see this tree and you fall in love with the species and you want one in your yard. We have one in our yard.
So how tall will they eventually get?
That's a good question. The original plants that came out of that original expedition, growing in some nice climates and good growing conditions, are approaching 70 feet tall now. I don't think we'd get that tall here. Plants in the Intermountain West tend to be smaller because of, for a number of reasons.
So lack of water.
Lack of water, yeah.
Cold winter.
Low humidity. And so I would guess probably you're looking at 50 to 60 feet tall for that species.
Which is
a great shade tree. They have a very soft texture. The needles in the summertime just have a very nice appearance to them, a fine texture. I think of it as a very polite plant. and the needles, when they turn in the fall, they're an orange, a very attractive orange. The bark is also very nice because it's a very interesting, kind of a fluted, and it kind of right below each branch is sort of an armpit. It's a little sunken area in the bark. And so it's a very interesting winter bark as well. That's one of my favorite trees. And people often ask about fast-growing trees. They want to get shade immediately. Most fast-growing trees aren't worth planting because they're a maintenance headache for years down the road, things like willow and poplar. But Don Redwood is one that I always recommend if people are looking at a fast-growing tree.
Is that Don, D-A-W-N?
Yes, D-A-W-N. The Latin name is Metasequoia, is the genus. Metasequoia glyptostroboides. Don
Say
Redwood.
Say that three times real
fast. Yeah, yeah. And it's one of the, you know, one of the few trees that are considered to be redwoods, a true redwood.
And that will grow in Utah, apparently.
Yeah, and it does great.
It's like the bald cypress. You usually see those in a swamp in the south, but Mike Coons was saying, well, they actually do grow here. It's like, okay. And that was one that he had recommended along with, let's see what other ones he's putting in. He was saying, just leave the Norway maples out. That was like a trash tree anymore.
Well, yeah, they're so common, and they are seedy. And there's so many other nice trees to choose from.
They make great helicopters.
Yeah.
And you can stick them on your nose if you're, you know, as a kid or whatever. But that's about all.
Yeah. I can see. Bald cypress do very well. They grow fast. They're very interesting. So they tend to be a little more chlorotic, I've seen, than Dawn Redwood. So sometimes you end up adding a little supplemental iron. But it's not a pervasive problem. I think if you're interested in bald cypress, it would be one well worth trying.
Did you see much winter injury from this last winter? I know with fruit trees, it's going to be an issue because it was warm, and then in December it dropped cold, and so a lot of the trees just weren't ready to get the cold temperatures.
It's a little early to tell. We had the same similar temperature fluctuations last year, and a lot of times we'd see trees that started to bud out, and then the temperature damage would show up. So sometimes you don't actually see it until shortly after bud break, and you'll see the leaves will start to expand, and then they'll die partway through the process and start to shrivel up, and the entire branch will die. So we really won't know, I don't think, I'd get a good idea what kind of winter damage we have until probably late April, depending on the year. I mean, we're so far ahead this year that we could be early April before, you know, we start to see these things.
And if there is no damage, we're so far ahead, we may get hit by frost anyway.
Yes,
so.
And that's a huge worry. I mean, if we get a late spring frost this year, it's just going to be devastating.
Well, we've actually pretty much reached the end of our time.
Oh,
it always goes by so quickly, and I appreciate you taking the time to come in.
It's fun to get somebody to stand still long enough to talk trees with them. So.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Ben Harris, board certified master arborist and owner of Branch to Bud Tree Care, has been my guest. This Saturday, March 22nd, from 9 to 11 a.m., he's giving a workshop at 444 East Center in Smithfield. The public is invited to attend. It's a free workshop, a fruit tree workshop, and you'll be teaching people how to basically prune.
Yeah, just all about fruit tree pruning.
Okay.
Everything you wanted to know.
If you have any questions, you can call Phyllis at 435-232-8010. And is this at a home?
Yes.
Okay, so the workshop will be held outside, so dress appropriately. And again, that's this Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. at 444 East Center in Smithfield. Coming up next is, we're going to have a quick break, but then we'll have Petals and Pros. Stay tuned.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, here for The Zesty Garden and Petals and Pros. And I just love to read to you. That's why I hang out here. It's just a privilege to do that. And today I want to share from one of my favorite gardening books. It's kind of a gardening and also memoir book called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson. Wendy is a friend of mine and a writer. And this is a wonderful book of 450 pages that she actually wrote in longhand, and it took her about 10 years to do it while she was at the Green Gulch Farm Zen Center in Marin County, California. She now lives there with her family at nearby Muir Beach, and she's a Buddhist meditation teacher. So she's a writer and a meditator and a marvelous, marvelous garden. And a lot of this book integrates Zen philosophy with gardening philosophy, and it works quite well. So I thought I would just read you a little bit of background about the garden and what she's doing with it, and spring, of course. She talks a little bit here about how Zen practice originates, and she says, it comes out of everyday life. Since the autumn day in 1975 when Peter and I walked into Green Gulch Valley, my practice has ripened in both garden and meditation hall. Both the meditator and the gardener in me are encouraged by the inscription on the Green Dragon Zen Temple bell and by the silence and sound of this old bell. The inscription is a lovely poem by Richard Baker. It's short. I'll read it for you. It says, awakened by this Japanese bell, the sky-headed, sea-tailed Green Gulch Dragon stirs the fine mists and rains of right Dharma for east and west. Farming and greeting guests, the pre-voice voice of this old bell is not hindered by the wind. I confess, she says, that on some mornings during Zazen, I am too tired from the previous day's pruning of the tangled thicket of Gallica roses to even hear the bell. It takes all my concentration just to stay upright, poised on the brink of sleep. But on other mornings when the garden has been kinder to me, the sound of the bell booms through to me during Zazen. Sitting drops a notch then, and tiny vanguard roots spread out from the base of my sitting bones into the dark ground. The Zendo meditation hall at Green Gulch Farm is the heart of the place, an old hay barn transformed to hold about 200 people. When we first came to Green Gulch, there were creaky trapdoors in the mud-encrusted floor of the ground-level hayloft. Hay had been thrown down through these chutes to the cattle, stanchioned below in the lower barn. Our first job was to scrape this mud off the hayloft floor and create a place to sit in meditation. Those assigned to this task worked for days. Often I thought of Heracles laboring in the Augean stables. Next, we cleared old harness and rusty hand plows, broken window frames, and hoops of baling wire out of the barn that adjoined the hayloft. We uncovered a catacomb of old box stalls underneath the piles of equipment. So we built up the walls of those horse stalls and made primitive rooms for student housing. I lived in one of those rooms with Peter when we first came to Green Gulch. The walls were so thin we could hear Jerome next door turning the pages of his book at night after Zazen. There were almost 70 of us living at Green Gulch in those days. There weren't enough rooms, so the newly arrived men slept in the Zendo at night. We built raised platforms, or tons, for Zazen and overflow sleeping, and one year we dried our squash and pumpkin harvest under those sturdy platforms. If there was to be enlightenment in the Green Gulch Zendo, the pumpkins would have their share of it too. Uchima Roshi, the head teacher at a monastery in Japan, wrote that in Zazen, we practice to save all beings. We sit like individual pumpkins in a vast field, aglow with our vow. Yet we are connected by a common vine that runs between us, a vine that sustains our shared life even when we forget our connections to one another. Underneath our sitting platform in the Green Gulch Zendo, as the field squash cured and ripened, I heard Roshi encourage us, "Pumpkins, sit Zazen!" And sit Zazen we did. We practiced meditation together every day from 4 a.m. until 6 a.m., and then again at 5:15 p.m. just before dinner, and at the close of the day from 7:30 until 9. Everyone followed the same schedule in those days. Most of us were in our early 20s. We were building Green Gulch Farm to fit our dream. We expanded the family kitchen in the old Wheelwright Ranch, added to the dining room to seat a large population of 70 residents, and built a small guest facility and conference center. At the same time, we were cultivating the heavy bottomland soil of the gulch and establishing the farm and the garden. We were quite idealistic and determined to grow our own food. We also didn't know much, especially about the rugged climate of the North Pacific coast. Our first year, we tried growing scores of crops, fencing off a quarter acre and planting like mad. We sowed lettuce and paste tomatoes, pickling cucumbers and wild radishes. We dibbled in lines of snow peas and rows of dry beans, and even planted some hills of peanuts. And then we hunkered down to watch what happened. The plants grew furiously, especially with their heavy complement of aged cow manure gathered from the lower barn. A silent communal work period was added to our schedule right after morning Zazen, before breakfast. Lou Hartman, a senior Zen priest and a great cook, would bake us fresh zucchini bread and serve it hot from the oven to tide us over on frosty mornings as we went down to work in the fields. Zen practice honors work. A day of no work is a day of no eating, is an old Zen proverb. We worked hard in those first years to establish the farm and to learn the lay of the land, teachers and students working together. Dainen Roshi visited us periodically from his meditation center in Minneapolis and did communal work in his meditation robes, tying up his voluminous Tang Dynasty sleeves and scrubbing out pigweed with a rusty hula hoe. In the renegade collection of old junk that filled the outer barn, we discovered a rickety cart that was spiffed up and hauled out to Tam Junction, the crossroads where the Green Gulch Coast Road meets the main road. From the back of this cart, Darlene sold fresh vegetables and flowers and homemade bread to our neighbors and visitors. Even though we were exhausted, life was good. But as we developed our practice and presence at Green Gulch, trouble cropped up in paradise. Babies began to be born, guests began to visit and want to practice with us. Farming began to take on a life of its own. We now kept chickens and a dairy cow named Daisy. Thorny issues pricked at the smooth, taut skin of our practice. Who was going to milk Daisy at 5 a.m. during Zazen? What did we do with our old chickens after we had enjoyed their eggs for 4 or 5 seasons? And were we really meant to leave our sleeping infants at home at 4 a.m. and all sit Zazen together in the Zendo? A fellow Zen resident summed up these dilemmas by asking a simple question. How do grown-ups practice Zen? What I have appreciated most about Zen practice is that it welcomes a core question like this one, meeting the world squarely without smoothing over prickly concerns that threaten the calm surface. Grown-ups practice Zen by sending our feeder roots deep into the bedrock of modern culture, fierce in the commitment to face the real issues and dangers of our times, remembering that every excellent endeavor turns from within toward the world, as Goethe wrote. At Green Gulch Farm, we have been lucky. Our covenant that allows us to be landholders within the Golden Gate National Recreation Area requires that we turn toward the world. If from prolonged meditation we get too misty-eyed about the ultimate reality of the moon shining in a single dewdrop, hikers passing through our preserve bring us back to earth by asking for directions to the nearest bathroom. And when the mad frenzy of harvesting more than 100 boxes of fresh organic produce for the market threatens the rhythm of daily life and obscures the dire situation of the world, the same guests passing through our fields restore us to our true work. I can't tell you how much it means to me, they often say as we crouch exhausted over our huge market crop of Romanian speckled lettuce, that this beautiful food is grown here at Green Gulch by people who meditate every day. Over the coming years, we have crucial work to do together. Our world faces unprecedented ecological destruction and soil disintegration that includes a massive dying off of species, degradation of air, land, and water purity, and a loss of soil health and biological diversity, issues all bound together by the stark reality of global climate change. We have no choice but to work together. This means getting into the traces with unlikely partners and pulling to reverse the tide of human greed and ignorance. The human race is 5 million years old, one of my close Dharma teachers reminds me, and it is time to act our age and fulfill our inheritance as human beings by responding to the cries of a world in trouble. I have great faith and confidence in our ability to wake up, to pierce the veil of drowsy denial, and to draw on the strength of our collective human thicket of intertwined roots. Despair is lifted by facing the truth of our situation and sustaining the gaze as we turn toward the world, inscribed on the face of the wooden sounding block that calls us to meditation every day are these simple words of reminder. Listen, everyone. Great is the matter of life and death. Awake, each one. Don't waste time. That was a reading by Wendy Johnson from Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. Here is that recipe for Lou's zucchini bread. 3 eggs, 1 cup of oil, 1.5 cups of sugar, 3 cups of grated zucchini, 1 tablespoon of vanilla, 3 cups of sifted flour, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon baking soda, 1 tablespoon of cinnamon, and 1/4 teaspoon of baking powder. Beat the eggs until they're light and foamy. Add the oil, sugar, zucchini, and vanilla. Mix lightly but well. Sift together flour, salt, baking soda, cinnamon, and baking powder. Add to the egg mixture and mix until blended. The batter will be stiff. The liquid in the zucchini comes out in the baking. Divide the batter into 2 greased loaf pans, 9 by 5 inches, and bake at 325 degrees Fahrenheit for about an hour. Cool on a wire rack. Cut into generous slabs and serve while still warm. It helps to eat zucchini bread on foggy, cool mornings, dreaming of the garden that is stirring to life just beyond the edge of your appetite. You can get this recipe on the website at upr.org under the Zesty Garden tab. I'm Nancy Williams for the Zesty Garden. I'll see you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com.
This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.